Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's January 24th, 2020 program. The governor's priorities for the legislative short session. This is the 19th program of the 2019-2020 programming year. My name is Eric Richardson, and I serve as the City Club of Eugene president. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. We have both in-kind and business sponsors. Today, our diamond sponsors are Kaiser Permanente, who exists to provide high-quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. The University of Oregon. Since 1876, the university has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information can be found at uoregon.edu. And Peace Health. Peace Health is a proud servant of the Eugene community, Lane County, and beyond, as your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years. Their mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. And Lane Community College. Lane Community College transforms lives through learning. It provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. More information can be found at lanecc.edu/programs. And we'd also like to thank the City of Eugene for their generous support of the City Club. Now to our program. Governor Brown grew up in Minnesota and earned her undergraduate degree from the University of Colorado Boulder. She came to Oregon to attend Lewis and Clark Northwest School of Law, where she received her law degree and certificate in environmental law. Kate Brown, Oregon's 38th governor, has over 25 years of experience in government. From 2009 to 2015, Governor Brown served as Oregon's Secretary of State, where she was a leader in increasing government transparency and accountability. She also created the Office of Small Business Assistance to help cut through red tape and allow businesses to grow and expand. As governor, she signed legislation to improve the state's education system, to add jobs by passing Oregon's largest transportation package, and to contain costs by improving government efficiency and accountability. She has also helped to ensure that 95% of adults and all children have access to health care. Quite an impressive record. Would you all please welcome our governor, Kate Brown.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm absolutely delighted to be here with you today at the Eugene City Club. I'm certainly looking forward to sharing with you some of my priorities for the legislative session. But before I do that, I know we have a number of elected officials in the room. So please join me in welcoming Senator James Manning and his lovely wife, LaWanda. Thank you for joining us. We have from the House, Representative Wilde, Representative Nathanson, and Representative Fahey. Thank you. From the County Commission, we have Commissioner Pat Farr and Commissioner Heather Buck. Thank you. From the Eugene City Council, Betty Taylor and Emily Semple. Thank you. Miss anybody? And of course, because I served with her in the House many, many years ago, your former mayor of the great city of Eugene, Kitty Piercy. And I know you're all excited to get to the Ducks Beaver game in a couple of hours, so I will talk quickly, but I look forward to answering all of your questions. Since becoming your governor, I've worked really hard to make Oregon a state where everyone can thrive, to build a better Oregon for everyone. And toward that end, we've made a lot of progress on our statewide goals. I was very excited in 2017 to sign the largest bipartisan transportation package since the Johnson era. That was President Johnson. Yes! $400 million per year focusing on safety, resiliency, and the drivability of our roads and bridges. Then the first time ever, a statewide investment in public transit. And that's also a really good thing. We are leading the nation in access to the ballot box with automatic voter registration. Yay, and paid post. Don't forget, paid postage is out there too. And because of that leadership, we are ranked number one state easiest to vote in and have some of the highest voter turnout. And I know if the City Club keeps up your good work, we're going to take that number one status in the country soon. So, yay. In my tenure as governor, we've invested over $500 million in affordable housing and rental assistance. The goal, of course, is to ensure that every single Oregonian has a warm, safe, dry place to call home, and that place is affordable and accessible. But just to give you a perspective, this four-year investment is more than we have invested in the entire past 161 years of statehood. Yeah. We passed a budget that protects health care coverage for a million Oregonians and every single child. We passed the most comprehensive reproductive health care bill in the country. Yay! The bill ensures that every woman, no matter her zip code, her income, or her immigration status, will have access to the full complement of reproductive health services. And working closely with your business community, we crafted the most progressive, the most family-friendly paid family leave policy in the country as well. Yay. I don't know if I'm supposed to clap as well, but I am. And as we speak, teachers and administrators are preparing for the largest influx of education funding that Oregon has ever seen, thanks to the Student Success Act. And we're ensuring that all of this new money is going directly into classrooms through a bipartisan effort to stabilize PERS rates for our schools. We learned this week, as this came out yesterday morning, that our state high school graduation rate has risen to 80%. It is the highest on record in Oregon history. And most importantly, we've seen significant gains in our vulnerable communities, our communities of color, and our tribal communities. This is specifically the result of targeted efforts to improve outcomes for these underserved students. But Oregon's state motto is, she flies with her own wings, not she rests on her laurels. So we are calling this round of conversations the 2020 Legislative Table Set. It's fitting because this year we're not only setting the table for the legislative session, we're truly setting the table for Oregon's future. We must do something meaningful and soon about climate change. You all know this is the issue of our time. We know that if left unchecked, climate change will have devastating effects on all that we hold dear. And future generations will rightly judge us not on the fact of climate change, but what we've done to tackle it. Oregon may be a small state with our modest population and 7 electoral votes, but it is a state with a $12 billion tourism industry and some of the fastest growing cities in the nation. We have 363 miles of beloved coastline and 30 million acres of forest, a little under half of the state's total land mass. Our state's heart and soul are in the ocean and those trees, as well as the natural resources industries that surround them, our farmers, our fishers, and our ranchers. We are being impacted by climate change now, with last year's water quality crisis in the Willamette Valley, the diminishing shellfish populations due to ocean acidification, and the voracious wildfires of 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018. And it's only going to get more challenging. After the Senate Republican walkout and the collapse of the cap and trade legislation last year, I did a lot of reflecting on how we can move forward. I met with folks from the timber industry and wood products. I toured sawmills, sat down with plant managers and suppliers, and had face-to-face conversations with Timber Unity. I met with the Farm Bureau, business leaders, and activists from all sides of this debate. I not only listened to them, I heard them. I've taken these conversations to heart, and we've made a number of serious policy changes to address many of their concerns. I am committed to crafting climate policy legislation that protects our environment and also grows our economy. In Oregon, we can do both. But before I get into the nitty-gritty details, I want to take a moment to reflect on the why. Because before we can discover what we have to gain, we should all be on the same page about what we have to lose. After the 2018 wildfire season, I established the Oregon Wildfire Council. We are currently fighting fires with last century's tools. The council's job is to modernize prevention, suppression, and mitigation of wildfires as our climate continues to change. We're in the middle of a perfect storm. Decades of federal land mismanagement combined with changing climate. Our mission is to keep Oregonians safe and our landscapes healthy. But we can't do that if we're running plays from last century's playbook. For resilient landscapes, the state must actively manage roughly 5.6 million acres of state forests and rangelands. We can do this through the thinning of trees, more frequent prescribed burns, and the removal of fuels for wildfire. There's no question that this is a major investment. The Wildfire Council estimates it will cost around $200 million annually over the next 20 years for prevention, mitigation, and suppression. But doing nothing is not an option. If we don't act now, the cost will be 11 times greater, not to mention the potential loss of homes, land, and life. And by investing in restoration treatments and forest health, Oregon can avoid costly damages while simultaneously creating jobs in rural parts of the state. Jobs like Forester Jana Peterson in Eastern Oregon, who works with local landowners to thin overgrown tree stands. She knows the science, she knows the land, and through her work thinning trees, she's making our forests healthier and more fire resilient, 1 acre at a time. Another great example is the work being done in Central Oregon with the Deschutes Collaborative Forest Project. The collaborative includes experts from every corner of industry and interest, timber, tourism, and conservation. These environmentalists, loggers, private landowners, and tribal members understand that their beloved forests are at risk unless they act now. And they have learned that this is work we must do together, which is why I'm asking your Oregon legislature to invest $200 million in wildfire prevention, mitigation, and suppression efforts. It's imperative that we preserve the beauty and bounty of Oregon, because our thriving economy is in part depending on our bountiful natural resources, our fisheries, timber, wine grapes, and wheat. So, when I drive through farm country, I love seeing signs of everywhere for our century farms, farms that have been family held for 100 years. Oregon currently has over 1,200 century farms, and 41 Sesquicentennial Farms. That's 150 years of family farming. To become a family century farm, families made and continue to make sacrifices so that their farms can stand the test of time. They are feeding our families. They are providing timber for our homes. They grow plants and seeds that make up our yards, plots, and properties throughout the state, and frankly, all over the world. These are billion-dollar industries that started with one family, one plot of land, and the persistence to make it happen. Our farmers are innovating every single day in the face of changing climate. Grass seed farmers are exploring no-till farming practices that lower fuel costs and retain moisture in the soil. Gingrich Farms in Clackamas County hires falconers to control pests instead of using harmful pesticides. Yeah, give them a round of applause. And every day, more Oregon farms are deciding to become vertically integrated, taking out the go-between to supply what they need to do business. These families are thinking ahead, hoping they will have something to hand down to their children and grandchildren. And now, we find ourselves in that very same position. Take, for example, Ben Doomling. Ben's family has been operating Xena Forest Products in the heart of the Willamette Valley for three generations. As a rural business owner, he realizes that climate legislation may cause him to tighten his belt in the short term. As Ben says, there is no magical free solution to this problem, but the cost of inaction may hurt my bottom line much more. The world's economies are rapidly transitioning away from fossil fuels. We need to continue to be a leader in this effort. There are so many incredible things about Lane County that make it a great place to call home. At a time when the rest of the state is growing rapidly, population here is slower but steady. I would put the Lane County industries in three categories: brews, brains, and lumber. You are leading the state in breweries, which I did not know, but I'm sure, yes. I'm sure it's with a little help from good Senator Floyd Prezansky, who couldn't join us today. And of course, in university, faculty, researchers, and students at the University of Oregon. And it's not surprising to find timber-related jobs that are 10 times more prevalent here than the nation, given the history of wood products and the world-class natural resources in our region. Lane County is very much a natural resource-dependent economy, but you are in transition, much like the rest of the state. And to echo Ben, these are the industries that will see the impacts of climate change, first in their crop yields and then in their bottom lines. In the same way that they are on the front lines of the impacts of climate change, they are also on the front line of being able to combat it. And that's why it is so important to have an economy-wide solution. The spike of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere has been building worldwide since industrialization, and it's caused by humans. The impacts of climate change are even more devastating to our most vulnerable communities. Communities of color, low-income communities, and rural communities already have higher rates of chronic diseases like asthma and heart disease. Climate change increases these existing health disparities. For example, in 2018, we saw a 20% increase in the number of asthma and other respiratory-related emergency room visits during the peak of wildfire season. Reducing fire emissions will play an important role in the worldwide effort to slow the gradual warming of our planet, which of course will reduce the risk of wildfire and thus in turn reduce wildfire smoke. Unfortunately, I think as everyone in this room knows, we're not going to get any help from the federal government. This current administration has already rolled back some 85 environmental regulations, and they are currently gutting the Clean Water Act, as well as many other laws that were signed by President Richard Nixon. The good news is that our state's founders, our nation's founders, gave states the ability to control our own destiny. And that's exactly what we're going to do. It's my hope and my expectation that your Oregon legislature will move forward with legislation in the February 2020 session that will set a science-based, economy-wide cap to reduce carbon emissions. Yes. The cap needs to have an enforcement mechanism that will keep us on track to meet our emissions goals, and it will do so in a flexible manner that makes significant investments and does not exacerbate existing economic disparities in our rural communities, communities of color, and tribal communities. Yes. So, as I mentioned, I've had the time to speak with numerous stakeholders and communities all over the state, and I'm certainly taking a look at our situation. And here's what we do know. The transportation sector is the biggest contributor to our statewide emissions, more than both the industrial and agricultural sectors combined. We know that the lion's share of transportation emissions occur in our more densely populated areas, which is why, after careful thought, we've come up with a geographic phase-in that will start in Portland in 2022 and then in 2025 expand to other populated areas. The legislature's still finalizing details. I call it a WIP, work in progress. But under this plan or a similar version, the majority of truly rural communities will be exempted from price increases at the gas pump. This may sound familiar because that's how we crafted our minimum wage increases to reflect the different economic regions of Oregon. The amendments also mitigate the effects of price increases on rural manufacturers like food processors, sawmills, as well as pulp and paper mills. Last week, representatives of the food processing industry, which opposed the bill last year, changed positions and came out in support of this new proposal, specifically citing the focus on energy efficiency as a better way to do business. Craig Smith of Food Northwest said, "Focusing on reducing carbon through efficiency rather than rate increases allows us to do business as a business to not only reduce our carbon footprint and to do so without the crippling effect of rate increases." We listened. We heard. We made modifications. And now, damn it, it's time to get this done. We know that capping and pricing carbon pollution provides a way for Oregon to meet our climate goals, grow our economy, and create new, good-paying jobs all over Oregon. These are jobs that can't be outsourced. And this particular proposal enables us to make investments to help all Oregonians transition to cleaner energy. It's critical that we get this done and do it in a way that will not exacerbate existing inequities, but invest in addressing them. So I want to leave you with one last story, and then I'm going to open it up to your famous City Club questions. Many of you may remember the 2018 Klondike fire that burned over 175,000 acres of the Rogue Siskiyou Forest in southern Oregon, devastating for forests, wildfire, and of course, residents in the area. Just days before harvest, a large out-of-state winery rejected over 2,000 tons of fruit from southern Oregon. $4 million worth of wine grapes left on the vine because the company worried the grapes were tainted by the smoke. But guess what? Oregonians stepped up. Lab analysis revealed that most of the crop was not damaged. So Willamette Valley Vineyards, King Estate Winery, Sylvan Ridge Winery, and Irie teamed up to help out. 1 week later, an extraordinary plan was set in motion. The winemakers bought as many of the grapes as they could, prioritizing smaller farms and vineyards that lacked crop insurance. they were able to save about a quarter of the season's crop. Far from every grape, but enough to make a difference. The four wineries worked as one to make three new wines under the label Oregon Solidarity. I've had some. It's really delicious. But the proceeds from the wines have been donated to Rogue Valley Vintners to help support our vineyards in the region. I share this story to make a larger point that despite an amazing industry-wide effort, they were still only able to save a quarter of that crop of grapes. What happens if in 2020 we have another devastating wildfire season? The story also reminds me that Oregonians are capable of seeing the forest through the trees, of thinking of their future rather than wallowing in the present. We take care of each other, even when it's not the most convenient to do so. And now, as we have done in the past, we must take the time to invest in the future of our state because it matters not just to our lives, but to the lives of our children and our grandchildren. Because we want a thriving Oregon economy 10 years from now, 20 years, and 100 years from now. I want all of our century farms to become bicentennial farms. Thank you, Senator Manning. I heard a really talented Salem High School junior speak this summer. Her name was Eddie Binford Ross, and she spoke on the steps of the Capitol building. She said, "We live in this hyper-polarized world where everything is left or right, red or blue, but right now we do not have time to waste. It is time for us to act. Damn, we're raising some really smart kids in this state." And she couldn't be more right. Together, we must act. Thank you very much. Thank you, Eric.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Today we are going to have our County Commissioner Heather Buck as our first questioner. Heather?
Thank you, Governor, for visiting Lane County and for your service to Oregon. I have a small cold I'm trying to stave off, as I'm sure many of you have been experiencing, so excuse my voice. But here we go. Lane County, as well as Marion County and the metro cities, are struggling to manage the impacts from growing populations of individuals who cannot afford a roof over their head. While attempting to be both humanitarian and fiscally responsible, the situation is dominating much of the work we are doing, and we're not sure if we can be successful on either front without state and federal support. There are those that suggest Oregon land use is responsible for both heavy housing and cost burdens and little supply of new and affordable homes. I testified in favor of what I thought was a reasonable and incremental solution, allowing counties discretion on siting accessory dwelling units on rural residential 5 lands, but the bill didn't reach your desk. There are voices for additional and larger reforms in Oregon's land use system that this year will mark 50 years since establishment. Are you willing to entertain reforms to this system to address homelessness, or do you believe that there is not a connection between the issues?
Thank you. I very much appreciate the question. And my heart goes out to all of the children, and there are a lot of children. Oregon Public Schools, 22,000 of our children homeless or housing insecure, our families, and of course our veterans. We have about 1,500 veterans that are homeless throughout the state. Every Oregonian deserves a warm, safe, dry place to call home, and it needs to be affordable and accessible. As I mentioned, the state has invested over $500 million in affordable housing, homelessness prevention, and rental assistance in the first 4 years of my tenure as governor. That's more than we have invested in the entire 160 years of the state. The federal government is no longer a partner in this work, and the state is stepping up. We have made substantial changes to policy, including Senate Bill 608, which was the goal to make sure that renters wouldn't be kicked out of their homes, provided a cap on rent increases, and House Bill 2001 to increase the density. I've been asked the question about changing Oregon's land use policy a lot. And let me tell you, I'm certainly willing to consider targeted changes to Oregon's land use policy. We did it in 2016 to expand the urban growth boundary for both an urban and a rural city. For whatever reason, Bend and Redmond were the two cities that made the criteria in that expansion. But here's the reality. We know that this state is in a housing crisis, but so is, frankly, every other state in the West. And very few of them have the wonderful land use planning policies that we have. The other piece is we are working to site affordable housing units for our most vulnerable Oregonians. From my perspective, it doesn't make sense to put them at the very edges of the city where it makes it so difficult to access services that can help them get their feet on the ground. Substance use treatment, behavioral health, job training, educational opportunities. They need to be co-located. And that's why I was really proud of the work we did on a bipartisan basis last session to invest $50 million into permanent supportive housing to help get our chronically houseless off the streets. And the best practice we know from evidence is through permanent supportive housing, and that has all of the key services located with the affordable units. So on a case-by-case basis, I'll certainly look at land use, but I don't want people to think that that is the reason why we have a housing crisis in this state. We have a housing crisis for multiple reasons, but we are going to, and so there is no one silver bullet. We're going to have to invest in what I consider a silver buckshot. We're going to have to try multiple different options, and we're going to have to work together closely with our local partners. Thank you.
Thank you. Betty Taylor, City Club member since 1990. I'm very concerned about House Bill 2001, the preemption of local authority. And I wonder, my question is, what can we do to prevent this is a destruction of zoning almost. What can we do to prevent people from buying what houses are affordable, demolishing them and building condos, which will cost more, which will destroy affordable housing instead of increasing it? Thank you.
So thank you, Councillor Taylor. I think there are a number of issues underlying this bill, and I chose to sign the bill because I wanted to make sure that single-family housing was not the only option in our urban areas. It does applies to limited, I can't remember the population number, but larger cities throughout the state. And there were two factors for me in this. Number one, we need to have more housing options available for families. And that means co-housing, duplexes, fourplexes, because obviously that will help decrease the overall cost of housing, provide more of the missing middle. And secondly, underlying our single-family zoning laws, frankly, is Oregon's history, very bad history of racism. And I know this might not have been the most perfect solution, but I do think it is a solution that addresses both of those issues. There is still more work to be done. I am confident that your legislature would listen to specific concerns in your region, and I would encourage you to talk with your legislators as you move forward in implementing these policies. So, thank you.
Todd Boyle, City Club member and a member of the First Decile Housing Facebook discussion group, where we discuss the problem of the lowest 10% of incomes of people. There's 36,000 people in Eugene below living on less than $1,000 a month. So I want to thank you and the legislature for House Bill 2001 and for the work you've done on ADUs. In fact, with all due respect to the city of Eugene, it has amazing barriers against any form of density. For example, my house, I have a 7,000 square foot lot, and I'm not allowed to build an ADU there because the lot's not big enough. But anyway, my question is this. Both the NIMBYs and the YIMBYs are pretty much in agreement that House Bill 2001 isn't really going to help the bottom 10 or 20%. Instead, it's going to help the third and fourth decile. So what I'm going to ask is, what's on the drawing board to try to focus the development toward those who need it the most at the bottom? Because the HB 2001 allows it. It enables some wonderful things, but they're not going to happen because the market is going to build market rate housing.
So thank you. You have articulately set forth the policy issues that we wrestle with. Obviously, two different types of housing issues. Number one, affordable housing for our most vulnerable, and then what I would call workforce housing or the missing middle or market rate housing. And this is an issue that I'm hearing from employers all over the state, that they are struggling to hire additional employees, bring new employees in because their employees, potential employees, can't find housing in the region. And so that is one challenge. And our work there is multiple, but frankly, this is a new work for the state. But we have done a couple of things like partner with private developers in rural communities, Pendleton, for example, and build 70 units there. We have done five pilot projects in our rural communities around the state, from Burns to Lincoln City. And then I asked the legislature for some money last budget cycle, and I got about $5 million to invest in our market rate accelerator for our rural communities. So that's what we're doing on the workforce side. On the affordable side, I mentioned the $50 million for permanent supportive housing. This is to get our most chronically homeless off the streets with wraparound services co-located with the affordable housing. And then in addition to that, we invested roughly, don't quote me on this, $280 million in building more affordable units. We went from building roughly 3,000 to 6,000 units a year. We're trying to quadruple the pipeline to 25,000 units a year. Margaret Salazar and her team have done a phenomenal job, and our local partners have been key. That's just not going to be enough, and we're going to have to leverage efforts. I know there's great work happening here in Lane County. I don't remember the name of the nonprofit, but the Tiny Homes, building the Tiny Homes. Square One went to a great fundraiser, Paella fundraiser. I know in Eugene you're famous for your Paella fundraisers. To build more tiny houses, I've asked the state Department of Corrections is looking at that. They are already building tiny apartments for our parks. Could we figure out a way to have our adults in custody build tiny houses at the Department of Corrections and get more units on the ground? So we are trying to be as creative, as nimble, as flexible as we can. We're trying to leverage every single partnership that we have. I am very much open to your brilliant ideas and your creative suggestions because, frankly, we need all of them. Thank you.
Skip Coburn, City Club member since 2018. Governor, appreciate you coming today. You talked in your remarks, you spent a lot of time on climate change, which I agree is the issue of our time. You also mentioned promoting economic growth. So my question to you is, what initiatives is your administration taking in 2020 and beyond to promote lending to small businesses, and encouraging the banking industry to respond to small businesses? Thank you.
Really appreciate the question. We have had numerous meetings with small business groups, and I had convened last year a small business cabinet. There will be legislation moving forward to leverage additional resources to assist our small business entrepreneurs, innovators, and creators. Our small businesses are truly the heart and the lifeblood of Oregon's economy. And what I hear when I talk to our small business owners is two things. Number one, access to capital, that's key. And we want to make sure that they can have access to homegrown capital. And number two, access to technical assistance. So we're hoping to leverage our efforts through Business Oregon, our economic development agency, to create more incubator space in communities around the state so that our small business owners can have access to the technical assistance that they need and create a roadmap for success. But happy to talk with you further about the work we're doing. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Governor. Thank you for coming. It's an honor to have you here. My name is Paul. I've been with the City Club for a year, and I hope to come back more. I'm here to ask a simple question, and it has to do with climate and climate action plan and related things. I'm also here in solidarity with all of Oregon, because I have an Oregon-wide question for you. And that question is, not why or anything, but when are you going to stand against the liquid natural gas pipeline that's being promoted by outside interests here in the state of Oregon? Is obviously a disaster, a climate disaster in process.
Appreciate the question. Let me be very clear. Any project moving forward in Oregon that impacts Oregonians and lands in Oregon has to be in full compliance with our state environmental laws. And my job as governor is to make sure that that happens, and that's exactly what I will do. I have been very clear that I am going to remain neutral on the project and make sure that Oregon's environmental laws and our regulations will be fulfilled and complied with.
Joel Curran, City Club member since 2012. Governor, in my opinion, one of the things that is holding the state back is the urban-rural divide. It sounds like some of the changes made in the environmental law are meant to address that divide. What other action is being taken to try to bring this state together?
Well, I really appreciate that question, because this is something that I have thought a lot about. And within my family, we have the urban-rural divide. Both in my immediate family, my sister is a cattle rancher in southeastern Montana, and I obviously am not, living in urban Oregon. But in my smaller family, my stepson lives in central Oregon and works for the Forest Service. And my stepdaughter lives in, shall we say, inner southeast Portland. So it exists within my very own family. And when my spouse and I started dating, he was working for the Walal Whitman National Forest. And so I, in Enterprise, Oregon, for those of you who are not familiar, I spent a lot of time commuting back and forth between Salem, Portland, and Enterprise, Oregon. And I learned a lot by spending time in what I think is one of the most incredibly beautiful parts of the state, and that is things are different, and communities are different, and that we have to really listen to and hear from them and incorporate their concerns into policy. And one of the favorite policies that we adopted as a result of my experience commuting back and forth was our legislators taking their hearings on the road. Because it might be sort of easy for folks from Eugene to get to Salem, but to get to Salem from Enterprise is 5 hours and 15 minutes, assuming the roads are good. So I just applaud the efforts of the legislature to continue to go out and have hearings across the state. I think that's really, really important. I do my best as governor to get across the state. I think one of the most important policies that I've worked on is the work to provide access to broadband in our rural communities. Yes, I've created a rural broadband office. Unfortunately, the Republicans, in irony of ironies, killed that bill at the end of the 2019 legislative session. Representative Marsh from Ashland is bringing that bill back, And it's my hope and expectation that not only will we have a little funding for the Rural Broadband Office, but that we can continue our work to invest in broadband infrastructure in our rural communities across the state. Secondly, I mentioned the Student Success Act. Our students in rural Oregon are one of the groups of students that I consider underserved. And one of the wonderful things that we did is we crafted the Student Success Act is to really provide a frame of equity and redistributive justice. And to me, that means making sure that our rural students have access to the resources and supports that they need to be successful. And our Student Success Act will make that happen. Most importantly in that work, we doubled funding for career and technical education so that every single high school in every state, in every community across the state, every student's gonna have access to ample funding for career and technical education. And we know that career and technical education changes lives. We know that it improves graduation rates because kids who have access to hands-on learning, they wanna stay in school. They understand that that opportunity literally connects them to the power of their own potential and, frankly, connects them to incredible career opportunities. We know that high school graduation rates in our rural communities go up with access to CTE. Let me give you one example, one astounding number on the CTE front, and that is our tribal students. Tribal students in the state who have access to more than two career and technical education classes, their graduation rate goes up from 60% to 90%. It's just phenomenal. So that's the kind of work we're doing. So I believe that we are one Oregon, and I believe that by working together, we can move Oregon in a way and forward in a way that benefits all of us. Thanks.
I'm Ralph Pledger, and I've been a member of the club for 3 years, and I'm asking a question, again, housing-related, and I'm asking it for a guest. And the question is, do you believe that housing is a human right, and should the homeless be a protected category?
So I believe that housing is a human right. I think that every Oregonian has to have access to a warm, safe, dry place to call home, and it has to be affordable. And I learned from touring one of your affordable housing places here in Eugene, it has to be accessible as well, that's critically important. As a lawyer, I have to tell you in terms of the technicalities, I'd want to study the issue a bit further before I make a commitment on it being a protected class. But I will certainly take that under consideration and have my legal team look at it, and we'll have a conversation about it. So I appreciate you raising it.
My name is Roz Stein. I'm a City Club member, and I was approached by a guest whose name is Amy, and she asked me to bring up a subject to you. She and her family have suffered greatly from the effects of aerial spraying in Oregon, and so she would like you to consider or discuss doing a moratorium on it. She says that the preponderance of Oregonians do not want aerial spraying. It promotes climate degradation. It affects families and people everywhere in the state. And she says that she feels that you could put a moratorium on it. It has been done in Europe, according to Amy. So I'm just passing along the message.
All right. Well, thank you, Amy, for your question. I don't know. I would have to take a look again at my legal abilities to do a moratorium. But here's what I do know. The vast majority of Oregonians agree that there needs to be further restrictions on aerial spraying. And I am absolutely committed to improving not just our statutes, but our regulations around this. And there are conversations happening as we speak between environmentalists and folks in the timber industry to figure out if we can move forward in a way collaboratively to strengthen our environmental and public health protections on this particular issue. I'm happy to, Kate or Charles are here and we can get you information. Yes, thank you.
I'm Rob Zako, City Club member. Thank you, Governor, for your leadership, for your love of Oregon, and for being here in Eugene today. As you know, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first step. And in 2017, you and Oregon took a big step on transportation with the 2017 Transportation Investment Bill. You're talking today about hoping to take a second big step with climate change in this 2020 legislative session. There's steps, and I understand that it's really hard. Politics, they are possible to bring people together and applaud your efforts to reach across aisles and do that. But if I could invite you to look a little ahead a bit, what are the steps ahead of that on transportation climate change that you don't see happening in this session, but maybe hope to accomplish in 2021 or 2022? Mm. Transportation climate change, what do we still need to do?
Wow. Okay. So you
thank
all,
you.
Thank you. Good to see you, Rob. You all in Eugene, Lane County are leading the way with your efforts to make sure that we are growing healthier, more sustainable communities by investing in bicycle and pedestrian access so that our kids can walk to school or scooter to school or bike to school safely. I think we're going to have to make more significant investments in this arena. I think I actually have toured, it's Bus Rapid Transit. What's the name? Emerald? Emrix? MX. Sorry, I couldn't remember the number. Name. Bus Rapid Transit is how I remember it. I've been on it. We're actually looking at that. In terms of how can we can move people faster in our Portland metropolitan areas. It's a pretty inexpensive, pretty effective way to move people rapidly. Yes, it is. So I just think we're going to have to move quicker, faster, and make these changes so that folks have alternative methods as opposed to driving to work in their cars. Because as I mentioned, transportation is 40% of our carbon emissions, and we are really struggling to get our hands around this. And so the work we did in the transportation package helps a little bit. The investments in public transit and bus systems and communities around the state helps a little bit more. But the work you all are doing day to day in your communities to make sure that folks can walk or run or scooter, any scooters in the room? No, nobody likes scooters. What else? All the other options, reducing carbon emissions. Archimodo. Yes, Archimodo to work. I don't know if that's going to be a verb. Webster's verb of 2020, Archimodo. All of those pieces have to happen more rapidly, and that's going to take all of us. It's not work that I can do by myself. We got to do it all together, and we all have to make an effort to make this change. And so whether it's legislative policies or significant investments, that's where we need to go. And that would obviously involve a discussion with about the highway fund and highway trust fund, but that's a conversation for another afternoon. So, all right, any more questions? Come on up. Did you become a member?
I did.
All right, Julie became a member. Let's give her a round of applause.
I've been a member for many minutes. So I just have a question. It's kind of in a couple parts. I was hoping you could speak a little bit to the funding that you received from George Soros and if there were strings attached to that, whether it had anything to do with your recent meeting with Hillary Clinton, this regarding any strings attached to that funding, or if that mainly consisted of a discussion around how to avoid your part in the Uranium One scandal or the shipping children outside of the state.
So, Julie, right?
Yes.
Okay. I am so excited. After 25 years of working on campaign finance reform, yes, the Oregon legislature sent an amendment out to the voters to amend our constitution to allow for reasonable campaign finance limits in Oregon. No one, yes, thank you, no one. No one should be able to buy a megaphone so loud that it drowns out all the other voices. And so you have an opportunity to vote on a constitutional amendment to Article 2, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. It will be on your ballot in November of 2020. Oregon is literally a handful of states without any restrictions on campaign finance reform. I will tell you, I did have an opportunity to meet with former Secretary Clinton when she was in town. She and her daughter were touting their book, Gutsy Women. I encourage you to read it. It's really great. And I appreciate Secretary Clinton's service to the state. I have not met George Soros, but I know that we have something very much in common, and that is our work, my work, to restore justice and fairness to our criminal justice system. Thank you. What we have not talked about in my last couple of days of traveling the state is the work we've done in the 2019 and the 2017 legislative sessions to, frankly, create access to justice in our criminal justice system. And let me tell you a couple of things that we've done. Number one, based on data from the Criminal Justice Commission that showed that African American and Latinx men were convicted at substantially higher rates than the rest of the population of possession of controlled substance, we reduced that from a felony to a misdemeanor. For the first time it is the only time that I can remember, we have been able to make significant changes to ballot measure 11 and allow our young people a second chance. And I am continuing to work to diversify our judicial branch. I appointed the first African American appellate judge to our appellate courts, Justice Adrienne Nelson. Give her a round of applause. Just to give you a sense on the Supreme Court, when I graduated from law school in 1985, there was one woman on the Supreme Court. Anybody know who it was? Who? Betty Roberts, that is correct. In my entire legal career and political career, public service, there has never been more than two women on our Oregon Supreme Court of seven. Since I have become governor, we now have five women on our Oregon Supreme Court, and the first woman, Chief Justice, Martha Walters, yay! So that's the work I'm doing.
So I didn't actually say that you had ever met George Soros. I asked about funding.
Yes.
So just that was the question.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So this is our last question.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Because we got to go watch the Ducks and the Beavers, right? Woo!
I think we still have time. Good afternoon, Governor. Thank you for being here. I'm Craig Opperman, City Club member since 2004. And I want to thank you additionally for your awareness of the crisis we have in the kids' intensive treatment service system. Regrettably, we've sent children throughout the state and a lot of from Lane County to out-of-state placements. They've ended up in hotel rooms because of a lack of the resources to help them deal with their trauma that they're acting through. And so my question for you is that I know you're aware of it. I appreciate the committees you've appointed. You appointed me to one of them. Thank you. They're good committees. But now it's time for us to act. And the action is really simple. We need to fund the programs we have here so that they can hire the workforce and expand their services to keep those kids here and treat their trauma here. There's going to be some requests going to Ways and Means and some work in this session. And maybe you can do additionals to that. But are you going to be able to get some support to the programs to keep those kids here? And thank what you have done.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your work in this area. And as you know, we're working hard to make sure that our children in foster care are safe, that we reduce the caseloads for our caseworkers, that we have the support and services in our community to keep our children in Oregon. And another pitch, we need more families to offer their services as foster parents. Let me tell you where we are, where we started and where we're at. The legislature has been a significant partner investing in our child welfare system. We have hired an additional 500 staff people at the Department of Human Services in our child welfare. Our caseloads are now getting more bearable. We are working to create what's called a system of care for our children with specialized needs. We passed Senate Bill 1 in the 2019 session, and we're able to fund it. We are going to be asking for additional resources to bring to recreate those beds in Oregon. But as my new child welfare director, Rebecca Jones-Gaston, said, we're not talking about beds. We're talking about services for children. The goal, obviously, is to keep the children with their families and provide wraparound services and supports to the families so the kids can stay in their own homes. If that's not an option, we have to be able to provide the support and services in the communities to which the children live. I wish I could pick on any of the legislators in the room, but I don't think we have anyone on the Ways and Means Committee. No, so I can't. But we will be asking for additional $4 million to start building additional services and support for children in, with specialized needs. And I will tell you then, in terms of our out-of-state bed count, we started at 88 in the spring, and we now have about 19 young people who are out of state. We're working hard to get every single one of those kids home.
Thank you. All right. All right. On behalf of the City Club of Eugene.
Thank you, Governor Brown. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you, Eric. And no, this is not Ninkasi, this is water.